Good evening, dear saints. It's already an extraordinary evening, and I think the Lord will continue to make it extraordinary, because I came out of my room this evening humming Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da, because tonight is symphonic, because the theme tonight lends itself to orchestration. It's vast. It's majestic. I don't have a word for it. It's epical statement of God revealed in one place only, the mystery of Israel and the church. That remarkable segment of Paul's apostolic consciousness, the heart of his whole perception of reality, Romans chapters 9 through 11. It's not an addendum. It's not an asterisk. It's not a footnote. It's not at the end of the book. It's smack dab straight in the middle. That everything the scholars say from chapters 1 through 8 are preparation, and the chapters 12 through 16 are the outfolding and the outworking. But the heart of the book of Romans, Paul's most systematic statement, and he's not a systematic theologian, but in this one book, in the answer to the question of the Church of Rome, is God finished with the Jew? Paul sets forth a view of such a kind that it can only be touched and expressed symphonically. So I wish I had a baton. I would click the podium and call the orchestra to attention and sound the great theme. Dun, 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 dun. So let's begin both with the first verse of chapter 9 and the last verse of chapter 11, just to see how Paul commences and how Paul concludes. Because the first verse, chapter 9, is a note of grief, deep agony of soul. I say the truth in Christ, I lie not, my conscience also bearing me witness in the Holy Ghost, that I have great heaviness and continual sorrow. Other versions say grief, anguish of soul in my heart. For I could wish that myself were accursed from Christ for my brethren and kinsmen, according to the flesh. So the symphony is sounded with a dun, 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 dun. It's a low note. It's a heavy note. It's a weighty note. But unless it begins like that, it cannot end on the triumphant statement that concludes these three chapters in Romans 11 from verse 33. Oh, the depth of the riches. Are you with me? Are you found the place? Romans 11:33. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. For who has known the mind of the Lord, and who has been his counselor? Or who hath first given to him, and it shall be recompensed unto him again? For of him and through him and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever. Amen. If I don't sing that for you at the conclusion of this night or sometime in these days, pursue me. We sing this at Ben Israel. It lends itself to music. It's symphonic. It's great. It's epical. To him be glory forever. That's not Paul tacking on a little nondescript word of little meaning, but that the glory of God that is affected by the restoration of Israel in the last days after millennial apostasy through a Gentile church is a theme of such note and such ultimate worth and revelation of God in his mercy and his essential character that it will reverberate for him forever. The church that is not forever minded is non-apostolic. So we want to enter into this remarkable symphonic sweep that begins with a note of lament and grief, with a strickenness for the condition of his brethren, that he would even wish himself accursed that they might know Christ, and ends with this triumphant doxology of praise. Oh, the depth of the riches. Listen, you dear saints, when's the last time that you exclaimed, oh? That one letter word is profound. Oh, it's not a word, it's a gesticulation, it's a gasp. Oh, the depth of the riches. It raises the question, what has Paul seen that brings a sober Jew of this kind to such an exclamation that is beyond sentiment or shallow emotion? This isn't Paul emoting. This is a man who's deep in God, and something has struck the inmost corridors of his soul of such magnitude and such weight that the only thing by which he could conclude with this measure of praise is, oh, the depth of the riches. Oh, oh. It's like a man being hit in the gut, in the solar plexus. He doubles over. Oh. It raises the question, what has he seen that we have not yet seen? Of course, we ourselves have not yet come to this exclamation. You, dear saints, if God will give us the spirit of revelation tonight to begin to glimpse what Paul has seen and what he describes as a mystery of which he would not have us to be ignorant, brethren, lest we become wise in our own conceit, you will be exclaiming, oh, also. And I think you need to. I think you need to move from this terrible beginning of, I would wish myself accursed, the strickenness, the grief that ends with the ecstasy. Because I don't think you can end with the ecstasy unless you begin with the grief. But of course, what reason would you have, being Chinese or Indian or what you are in your exotic colors, shapes, and sizes? What, for what reason would you say, I would wish myself a curse? For what reason would you feel stricken for the fallen condition of a people who are not your brethren? So, of course, we can only ascribe this to Paul because he's speaking only out of his Jewish ethnic identity for his own kinsmen. And that exempts you from any necessity to feel a grief of that depth. And because you don't feel the grief of that depth, you are permanently shut out and limited to a range of emotion and life that is beneath God's intention for you and that would have otherwise revealed his glory. You're shallow, all too shallow, one-dimensional, all too one-dimensional, because the only thing calculated to bring you into a depth of apostolic range of emotion, feeling, thought, and consideration is the mystery of Israel itself. Too bad you're not Jewish. Then you could have identified and share Paul's grief. But let me ask you, though you're not Jewish, are not this people equally your kinsmen? Are they not your brethren? And who are the least of these his brethren to whom we shall be bidden to express mercy that we might enter the kingdom prepared for us in Matthew 25 as reward? Are you getting me? Listen, the issue of kinsmen and brethren is more than the issue of ethnic and racial identity. It's the issue of spiritual identity. And if they are the least of the Lord's brethren, but his brethren, even in their unbelieving condition, what ought they to be for you? Here's what I want to tell you. Paul is grieved in his deeps, not because he's a Jew, in identification with his own natural kinsman, but because he's an apostle. Because he's an apostle, he's sounding the heart of God. That's the grief that's being expressed. And so, to whatever degree we are apostolic, we have access and right to express and know the same degree of grief, because if we don't begin with the grief, we'll not end with the ecstasy. I'm pleading for the Church of Asia tonight to save it from a one-dimensionalism of being merely charismatically correct. I don't know how to express it. We've got to come out of our skins. There's got to be something expansive that has come into our souls that is uniquely the consequence of the beholding of a mystery that is at the very heart of God and the center of Paul's apostolic consciousness in the greatest book of Romans. But I'll tell you what, once you begin with the grief and end with the ecstasy over Israel, you'll go on in a range and depth of emotion and reality that eclipses Israel and touches every question. There's something about the mystery of Israel. I don't have a word for it. There's a dynamic. There's something in the nature of it that once we perceive it, eclipses and exceeds even the issue of Israel itself. It even eclipses and exceeds the issue of the church itself, because the one issue that eclipses both Israel and the church is the glory of God forever. And once you have tasted that and been lifted in that exhilaration through the revelation of the mystery, it will touch every other consideration that ever comes before you. Everything in your future will be affected subsequently once you have been inducted into the mystery of which Paul says he would not have you to be ignorant, brethren. So we're not going to go through a verse-through-verse exposition of three chapters, but I want to just touch some of the highlights of the concluding chapter, Romans 11, which is the heart of the great mystery. Here's the apostle faced with a question by the Church of Rome. Is God finished with the Jew? Has Israel blown it? Have they exhausted their last grace, having stoned the prophets and now crucified the Lord of glory? Is God finished with them? And are we now the church, the new Israel of God? And we replace them and we take over where they left and we complete what they failed to perform. Paul's answer to that question, what shall I say? The weight and the fate of the church, its destiny, its call, its significance, not only for the Jew but for the Gentile also, rests on our understanding and apprehension how Paul answers this question. And in my experience in my 42 years in the Lord and crossing paths and touching the lives of significant ministers who have confessed to me, Art, I don't know what it is, but I have never understood Romans 11. It's a mystery to me that I've never understood. Pity, because it's at the heart of Paul. How is it you understand other things and miss this? Are you having some difficulty? Is there some barrier? Is there some Gentile pride that keeps you from being able to comprehend the mystery? Because mysteries only come as being revealed. What is obstructing the revelation? Seeing that you know so much about other apostolic themes, what keeps you from the apprehension of this? Is there something deep in your Gentile pride that is loath and resistant to recognize that there's yet a destiny for this nation, despite its fallenness, despite its undeservedness, and you're loath to grant what God wants to extend in mercy? You will not elect what God will elect. You will not choose what He chooses. There's something stubborn and difficult at the heart of Gentile pride, and nothing more reveals it than the issue of Israel and the Jew as God sets it forth in this magnificent chapter. So how does Paul answer the question? I say then, verse 1 of chapter 11, hath God cast away His people? God forbid. I don't read Greek, I don't know Greek, but I'm told that in Greek, his statement is the most devastating, final, ultimate, convicting, expression that could be given to the rejection of the thought that God has cast away his people. God forbid. Let it be the farthest consideration from you. Don't even intimate or ever consider that God is finished. God forbid that you should take that as your thought. For I am also an Israelite, the seed of Abraham, the tribe of Benjamin. Because if God has cast away his people, what am I doing as a believer? That my very salvation is an indication he's not totally cast away. There's a remnant. There are people yet to be saved and to be redeemed. Finally, even all Israel will be saved, as we read it later on in verse 26. And so he goes on to develop his thought, which we will not and have not the time to attend, and even quotes from the section in Isaiah chapter 6, which we have been considering in these days. In verse 7, what then? Israel hath not obtained this which he seeketh for, but the election hath obtained it, and the rest were blinded, according as it is written. Written where? In Isaiah chapter 6. That God hath given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see, ears that they should not hear, unto this day. The curse pronounced upon them by the man who said, who shall go for a send me? Still it remains. They're blinded. They're out of it. But they're being out of it temporarily. It's not a permanent rejection. And it's serving certain purposes of God that has to do with the Goyim, with the Gentiles. That somehow their momentary historic removal makes place for the same gospel to come to those who were never candidates, the Gentiles. There's a mystery that Paul is beginning to unfold. Something has to do with Israel being set aside necessarily in blindness and judgment, in a right judgment of their sin, but it opens a door for the consideration of the Gentiles. For what purpose? Because he says then in verse 11, have they stumbled that they should fall? Is this a permanent disqualification? God forbid. Here he again uses the very strong language. But rather, through their fall, salvation is to come unto the Gentiles for or so as to provoke them to jealousy. And here we hear dun 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 dun. A theme is being introduced. A mystery is being unfolded. Yes, they're set aside, but there's a strategic consideration in the mind of God, the genius of God, that makes it necessary that salvation might come to the Gentiles, not to enjoy it in themselves as an end in itself, but so as to provoke them to jealousy. There's a reason for your salvation, you dear saints, that you have not yet considered before tonight. Your salvation is not the end in itself. It's a means to an end. A great end in the redemptive genius of God for a fallen Israel's sake. That because salvation has come to you through their fall, you might move them to jealousy by the fruit which you exhibit by having received their covenantal blessing, which they have disowned by their sin. And in such a way, so conspicuously, as to move them to jealousy, because being Chinese and Oriental, you're essentially more Hebraic than even they are. You're exhibiting the fruit that they themselves should have borne. Something has happened where the Jew least expects to find it. With the Gentiles, there's a purpose for your salvation beyond yourself. And in fact, this purpose saves us from an egocentrism, even of a spiritual kind, by which we are the measure of all things. The church, its benefit, its blessing, its numbers, its program, its budget. Us. What saves us from that inveterate self-centeredness that was with us in the world and is now presently with us in the church no longer of a carnal kind, but now of a religious or a spiritual kind. We, us, me, the church, our program, my denomination, my ministry, I. It's a consideration to which we're called beyond ourselves and outside of ourselves to move them to jealousy. While in the same chapter we're told they are the enemies of the gospel for your sake. What tough customers. You would have been afraid to pick me up off the side of the road 42 years ago as a hitchhiking Jewish atheist. I was a foreboding, angry-looking man, tough. But praise God for those who stopped. There's no tougher opponent to the gospel than the Jew. We not only reject it, but we have our alternative messianic programs, one of which is called Marxism and communism, or socialism, or every kind of ism, or a harebrained thing that men can conceive as messianic alternatives we Jews have invented. We are the enemies of the gospel. And you're in a shallow condition because you have not met us and confronted us and challenged us with the foolishness of the scandal of the gospel. Nothing more reveals the absurdity of the message that we're called to bear than bringing it to an erudite, sophisticated, and accomplished Jew. We're not talking about some drunk rolling in the gutter who knows he's lost. We're talking about men accomplished in the world. For the world is essentially a Jewish world. It's designed like Marx and Freud and Steven Spielberg and Einstein, that the three greatest geniuses of the 20th century who have set the whole tone and content and structure of the modern world happen to be Jews. When you touch a Jew, you're not just touching an ethnic minority, you're touching a people who are at the heart of a world system. And they'll gnash upon you with their teeth. I'm understating the case. God has given us a formidable opponent, and they have every reason to reject our message. There are Jews who will cross the street rather than allow the shadow of the spire of a church to fall upon them if it has a cross. They can't bear to hear the name of Jesus, because in that name, Christ, they have been persecuted and hounded and raped and pillaged and destroyed through the centuries. Every crusade was financed by looting Jewish communities in Europe. Jews locked themselves in their synagogues as a final defense, and the synagogues were burned to the ground. The great church in Esslingen, Germany, where I have such a remarkable identification, having been a GI in Germany, was built over the ruins of the synagogue burned in the Middle Ages by the Crusaders, where the entire Jewish community was burnt to a crisp, because they would rather die and sanctify the name of their God than to be baptized as Christians. You've got your work cut out for you. And you're not going to have to run to New York to meet Jews. They'll be coming here, as I hope to show you in subsequent talks. God will proliferate them throughout all nations, not only to sift them through the nations, but to sift the nations through them. Because the measure by which God will be eternally determine the destiny of goats and sheep is over one question in Matthew 25. What did you do for the least of these, my brethren? And if they're not your brethren as they are his brethren, you're not likely to do anything, especially if the doing of anything will imperil your life and threaten your security and that of your family. And why should you do it for them? What did they ever do for you besides supporting Chinese restaurants? Don't you understand the mystery? That a Gentile church is willing to extend itself sacrificially for a people who are different and other than their own. That by every natural human reckoning, Gentiles should be envious, spiteful, critical of Jews. And when they come to us, they'll be in the condition that deserves that assessment. And yet you're going to be kind and generous and loving and gracious, because it says in Ezekiel 20, Lord says, I'll meet with you in the wilderness of the nations face to face. I'm saved. Because in Gentile faces I saw the light that lightens the goyim and the glory of the people Israel. I couldn't see it in the glory of the people Israel now in their apostate condition, but I saw it in the face of that girl that I met in Europe 42 years ago, who had graduated high school and was on vacation. And I don't know how we bumped together and walked the woods surrounding the Swiss city. And I'm probing her motives. I'm a disillusioned ex-Marxist, a humanist with failed expectation for mankind, terribly disillusioned and hopeless. And here's this little girl being nice to me. I'm probing her motives. Hey, why are you being kind to me? I'm a stranger. Why aren't you afraid? I'm fearful. Oh, she said, it's the love of God. Listen, I don't have patience with religious cliches having come out of political cliches, love of God. So we walked a little further. How come you're being kind? It's the love of God. How come it's the love of God? I thought, if this kid mentions the love of God one more time, she's had it. My hobby is to find Christians and wipe them out. So what is this little girl to me? So she mentioned God once more. I said, look, you're a nice kid. Appreciate your kindness. But I want to tell you, I cannot stand this God talk. It rubs me raw. Where is God in the Holocaust? Where was God? Where in this world that's collapsing and is on the verge of atomic annihilation and the racial discord? And where's God? God, don't give me this God talk. I said, tell me, answer me one question that no Christian has ever successfully answered for me. You're talking about God? How do you know that He is? I thought, I got her now. But was she going to tell me some little brittle answer she learned in Sunday school? I'll roll over her with my intellectual steamroller and leave her in the dust. So she raised her little Gentile face to me. And I mean Gentile face. Snub-nosed, freckled, sandy-haired. She came from the Midwest in America, what we Jews call a WASP, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And she lifted that face to me, beaming with the light of God, and she said, I know God, Art, that God lives because He lives in me. And down went the ox felled. Boom. I went down. I mean, I stood, but there was an inward collapse because that simple answer was not a cliche. There was a power to that statement because that little Gentile face proved it. There was something in that face. It was the light that lightens the Gentiles, which is equally the glory of the people Israel. And I'll tell you what, university graduate that I was, well-traveled man that I was, pseudo-intellectual that I was made for the first time jealous for what this little Gentile girl had in the simplicity of her faith, and that I lacked in my cynicism and overwhelming discouragement as a man in the world. That's how God began with me, saints. You need to read the book Ben Israel, because it's the record of a man uprooted from California, brought out of the teaching profession in a year's leave of absence, traveling with a pack on his back, depending upon the mercy of those who will pick him up and extend grace through 14 months of travel through the whole of Europe and the Middle East, concluding in Israel, where God called me by name in a messianic bookstore. It's a picture of the future. It's a microcosm of a soon coming macrocosm of Jews being uprooted from their places of security and their categories, their mental categories and values uprooted, loosed, and then filtered and sifted through the nations that they might be picked up, that they might be encountered, that the face of God might be revealed to them, that they might see in the faces of Chinese believers what I saw in the face of that little waspish girl in the outskirts of Zurich. It's the mystery, you dear saints, and you need to be conscious of it and an anticipation of it and already sing to the issues that will affect your face. This is a great verse, Romans 11:11. May it be branded on your hearts. It's the heart of the mystery where Paul begins to introduce that there is a reciprocal relationship between Israel and the church. That God has ordained something in his own supreme wisdom that has to do with entities who are in history at enmity with each other. There's no reason why a Gentile should dispose himself toward a Jew and so exhibit something as to move a Jew who is the natural enemy of the gospel to a jealousy so as to partake of it. It means, what kind of exhibition are you going to make? What are you going to demonstrate that will move Jews to jealousy? What, your choruses, your superior services? Paul doesn't tell us. There's no footnote. But it implies a demonstration of an ultimate kind that, for the want of a better word, is heavenly. It's a reality that Jews would have never before ever seen. In fact, it's probably the same thing spoken of in Ephesians 3:10. It's the wisdom of God demonstrated through the church, which is what God is in himself, in his nature and his character, which can never be revealed sufficiently through an individual virtuoso saint, but only through the relationship between saints. That when they come to you in the communities that you will have established, which are also places of refuge and flight, you receive them in the corporate strength of the body that is there and has passed through its own trials and preparations. So when the Jews come, however offensive and mean-spirited, you will not be discouraged by them. You're going to be tested. They're going to be ungrateful. They're going to be mean-spirited. They're full of prejudice. They attribute their distress that has come upon them suddenly to the collapse of the church, to the fraudulence of Christianity itself, and you're Christian, and you're taking them in. And if you need their approval and you don't get it, and if they're mean-spirited and speak back to you, if they don't like your wonton soup and you don't have bagels in the freezer, and you offend them, how will you react? What you do, what your face shows, if you're merely only polite in the Chinese manner, all you're exhibiting is a Chinese culture. But if you show the face of God, an unconditional love that cannot be offended against, you have transcended what is Chinese and you have indicated and shown a kingdom of another and a heavenly kind. But I want to tell you, you'll not succeed in that sudden moment when it comes if you are not in preparation from now. There's a strategy of a divine kind that's breathtaking. They have fallen, but so that salvation might come to the Gentiles, in order to provoke them to jealousy. May you succeed in that in the appointed time. Because if the fall of them be the riches of the world, and the diminishing them the riches of the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? If this blessing has already come to the Gentiles through salvation, what will their return mean? Paul is implying there will be a return. God has not permanently cast away his people. There is yet a destiny to be fulfilled. And it'll only be fulfilled, as we will see later on in this chapter, through the mercy that comes to them, especially and exclusively through a Gentile church. Why should you, at risk and peril, extend yourself for a people who are not like you and are other than you, and are more likely to be the objects of your envy or your criticism and your love? Because in your ability to identify with them and for them, you are at the same time fulfilling the mystery of Ephesians 3:10. You're demonstrating another wisdom. You have broken through the power of self-interest and things as they concern you, and you are living for and willing to sacrifice for another. That is the wisdom of God portrayed by Jesus at the cross, and will be portrayed by the church in its response to the Jew in the last days, fulfilling the mystery of Ephesians while it fulfills the mystery of Romans. Who's sufficient for these things? Certainly it's going to require something more than we understand by charismatic. And it's that something more that glorifies God through the church forever. Because at the same time that God is through the church restoring Israel, the church has come to such a place of stature and beauty of character and nature and life, exhibiting the very magnanimity and graciousness of the Lord himself to an undeserving and unappreciative people, that the Lord not only has by it a restored Israel, he has a bride for the bridegroom. How did you think you were going to attain that bridal status? By magic? You're going to attain it by the crisis of Israel that requires you to be Christ-like. That's the mystery. Can you see it? Can you say, oh, the depth of the riches? This is phenomenal that a crisis of necessity comes to us as Gentiles, as the church, brought about by Israel in its abject condition in the last days and time of Jacob's trouble, that compels us to meet them on such a ground and in such a spirituality that we would never ever have sought for ourselves nor attained unless this crisis of necessity had come upon us through them. That God is using unbelieving Jews, an apostate nation, to bring the church to a place of ultimacy in God, by which it is fitted to be a bride for the bridegroom, having the glory of God. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. To use the one for the other, that unbelieving Jews in their untoward and apostate condition, heightened by the sudden uprooting of the last days in the time of Jacob's trouble, is the very factor that precipitates and compels us to an ultimate spirituality in being to them what we ought, that fits us for our own eternal destiny. Unless it comes to you by revelation, my speaking is vain. But our hope and our prayer is that the speaking will itself constitute revelation to those whose hearts are disposed to receive it. Of course, Paul would not have you to be ignorant of this mystery, brethren, lest you become wise in your own conceit. It's the one mystery that if you fail to apprehend it, there are terrible negative consequences. You become swollen with conceit. You become hotshot. You become the kingdom now. You're going to take over the world. You're going to take over all institutions and society, and you don't have to wait for the Lord. You yourself are going to do it. In fact, you are even now the kingdom. That's vanity. That's pride. That's being swollen in your own conceit, which is the inevitable consequence of the failure to receive this revelation. Because this revelation, by its nature, tempers the church, humbles it, gives it a mood of understanding that saves it from going off into its own conceit. See the benefit, the remarkable consequences in the issue of this mystery that is central to Paul's whole apostolic consideration of the faith. But it's not yet central to you. And until it is, you have no claim to be apostolic. And when it will be, it will make requirement of you of so ultimate a kind that the only way that it can be fulfilled is on the basis of his resurrection life, which is the basis by which I am speaking tonight and all the other speakings. Because this mystery, dear saints, as Romans 11:33 through 36 says, is of him, but it is also through him, that it might be to him as glory forever. In a word, God is calling the church to an ultimate call of a kind which it cannot fulfill on its own fundamental evangelistic or even charismatic ability. It requires the ultimacy of his spirit and of his life, or you cannot meet the contingency of the crisis that comes with Israel, as will be forced upon you in the last days in Malaysia. But the result is how much more their fullness. For I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I'm an apostle of the Gentiles, I magnify my office. Did you ever wonder why God took a fisherman, Peter, and makes him the apostle to the circumcision? And takes a great rabbinical student of the Rabbi Gamaliel and makes him the apostle to the Gentiles? Isn't that a confusion of roles? Isn't that misusing the remarkable background and equipment that Paul had as the Hebraic sage that he was? Why would God make him the apostle to the Gentiles? Because the issue of the Gentiles is the issue of Israel's redemption. Why? Because it confounds the wisdom of the world that Gentiles should be willing to extend themselves for another who is different and other than themselves, and to do it at a time and at a condition in which they will not receive any necessary gratitude and in their ability to extend mercy and to be what they are, what they ought, and reveal the face of God in unconditional love, indicates that the church has come to a qualitative place of another kind, of an ultimate kind, that for the want of a better word we can describe as bridal, and would not have come to it except through the crisis of necessity brought by the Jews in that condition. This is a mystery. It's a mystery that requires to be fulfilled, and it will be in the last days, so that they might return to Zion as the redeemed of the Lord. There'll be a remarkable harmony with a redeemed Israel in the earth and a glorified church in the heavens, now fulfilling the places made vacant by the displaced angelic realm that has fallen, formerly called the principalities and powers of the air. So that you that will be occupying those offices, some of you will be ruling over 5 cities and some over 10. But for the first time, there's a harmony both in heaven and earth with a redeemed Israel in the earth and a glorified church in the heavenlies ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. So Paul says, if by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are of my flesh and might save some of them. For if the casting away in verse 15 be the reconciliation, the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead? You cannot estimate what Israel's restoration will mean to fulfill their calling and their destiny to be a nation of priests and a light unto the world. Because if priests don't come to us, which is their election and call, how shall we discern the difference between the profane and the holy? Only priests can instruct us. Only priests can be the example. We need to have a redeemed Israel sending its representatives into Malaysia and into Asia and into Africa and into all the nations of the world to bring that quotient and dimension of the meaning of holiness and what is sacred to those who could not obtain it except by their demonstration. Because God has called them, and the election and the callings of God are without repentance. They are irrevocable. Paul says this in Romans 11. We're going to see it. The gift and callings of God are irrevocable. Once he's called the nation to be a nation of priests and light unto the world, they have to fulfill that, because if they don't, how is God God? The issue of Israel's restoration is the issue of God as God. He's made a covenant with them and promises that does not rest upon their virtue, because their track record stinks and will become worse before the end. It has nothing to do with their ability to attain on the basis of their merit, but solely on the exclusive grace that is given in mercy, because God is God. The issue of Israel's restoration is the issue of God, not just in the last days, but his glory forever. For if the first fruit be holy, the lump is also holy, in verse 16. If the root be holy, so are the branches. And if some of the branches were broken off, and you, being a wild olive tree, were grafted in among them, and with them partakest of the root and fatness of the olive tree, don't boast against the branches. But if you boast, thou bearest not the root bears you. You will say, but the branch is broken off, that I might be grafted in. Yes, true. Well, because of unbelief they were broken off, and you stand by faith. But don't be high-minded, but fear. For if God spared not the natural branches, take heed lest they spare not you. Behold, therefore, the goodness and severity of God on them which fell severity, but toward thee goodness, if you continue in his goodness, otherwise thou shalt be cut off. And they also, if they abide not in unbelief, shall be grafted in, for God is able to graft them in again. What a remarkable picture of wild olive branches, wild branches that could not bear fruit being wild. They can only become fruitful by being grafted into one tree, which is Israel. And if they're too proud to be part of that tree, and they don't like the looks of it, it's too gnarled, it's too ugly, its history has been too desperate, and they would prefer to be a New Testament entity called the church independent of the Jew, they will be fruitless in any true and eternal sense of the word. Because fruit only issues from the sap, and the sap only issues from the root, which is the tree of Israel, even in its present apostate condition. You've been grafted in. And until you're conscious of that grafting and grateful for it, you cannot appropriate the sap that you might be made fruitful. And if you're not fruitful, by what means shall you move them to jealousy? Something needs to come into the consciousness of the church, even the Chinese church, maybe especially the Chinese church, especially the Asian church, because it's so removed from what they think is the Western Jew, is your identity and relationship, the intrinsic binding by the mystery of God with that people as being part with them in the commonwealth of Israel, who are formerly far off without God, without hope in the world, and been brought nigh by the blood of Jesus. Until you know that, really appreciate that, really are grateful for that, you can't partake of the root. Nor will you welcome them back into their own tree. But if you were able to be grafted in wild thing that you were, fruitless, you would have been doomed to be limited to that kind of puerile activity, except that the privilege of being grafted in to that tree. And if you could be grafted in and made fruitful, how about the natural branches if they be grafted in again? My first Assemblies of God pastor said, I've never seen a convert like you, Art. You took more notes. You sucked up everything. You drained me. In 3 months, 6 months, you got anything and everything that I had to give. I've never seen such an insatiable new believer sucking up this stuff as if it's his nature. Which indeed it is. I was grafted back into my own tree. God is able to graft them in again and will be glorified thereby forever. So don't you boast, but pray for their return, because what will their return be but life from the dead? For in verse 25, I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery. Listen, saints, you can have an appreciation for the state of Israel and desire its success and even go and plant trees and go to the Feast of Tabernacles and have all that nice sentimental and schmaltzy stuff that blesses your soul, but you're missing the mystery. I want to make this clear to you. Merely to have an affinity for the present state of Israel and pray for 2 minutes for the peace of Jerusalem is not the same as understanding and receiving the mystery of Israel that makes of the church an ultimate requirement that can only be met on resurrection ground. It's cheaper and easier to plant a tree than to be a saint of the resurrection and move Jews to jealousy by something that you exhibit corporately in the quality of the life of your fellowship, for which there's no better word than heavenly. In fact, we would rather go to Israel than stay home and give ourselves to that kind of struggle and requirement. So I often say, you can as much offend against God and be opposed to the ultimate fulfillment of his mystery by having a shallow and sentimental affinity for present Israel, as much as being anti-Semitic and totally opposed and indifferent to the destiny of Jews altogether. There's only one posture and one call for us that's valid. It's Paul's apostolic apprehension of the mystery and its fulfillment through us, that we should not be ignorant or wise in our own conceit. Blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. Dum, da, dum, dum. Israel will not be saved by any conduct of its own. Why is that? That they've got to be reduced to dry bones, where they themselves say, we are cut off, we are not hope. Because Israel and the Jew are the archetypal paradigm of human sufficiency, of man in his own ability to do and to perform. They cannot succeed on that basis. Israel's destiny is not to exalt itself as a nation, but to glorify its God who raises them from the dead. This is an issue of humanism. God is making a demonstration of a witness nation and showing that though they have such prominence and such ability and cleverness and prowess and military ability and finance, so as to take a dead nation, a malarial swamp, and in a half century make it a modern high-tech civilization, they cannot succeed on the basis of their merit nor their ability. For in man is no good thing at all. He's using Israel as a text case to show the world that its presumption that man can succeed independent of God is the most vicious lie, contrary to the grace that he would extend to all those who acknowledge that in themselves there is no good thing at all. You've got to understand the magnitude of this drama and what is at stake here, and why Israel must necessarily fail, why there must necessarily be an expulsion and an uprooting, why the return must be totally supernatural and be the evidence of his mercy through the church. Because they don't deserve it. And what did we deserve by which salvation has come to us? What, because you were clever? You were nice? You had well-meaning intentions? You never hurt anybody? You were moral and God needed you? It's exactly the same mercy that has come to us. And if we don't recognize that, that we had no qualification and no deserving for our own salvation, and that what has come to us that we are enjoying by the grace of God without our own merit, how shall we extend mercy? Because Paul says that by your mercy they might obtain mercy. And if you have no mercy to give, what shall you extend? So here's a requirement to move from the level of doctrine and about articles of belief, creed, from creedal faith to existential appropriation of the mercy that we, of which we need to be conscious and celebrate, or else we'll have nothing to give. So let me ask you, have you got a face to show the Jews in the last days that can love them unconditionally despite their mean-spirited ingratitude at the cost of your hospitality to them, by which you'll be risking your life? Because they will be hounded by such vile Islamic forces that will not be satisfied with anything less than their death. How will they treat you if they learn that you have succored these Jews whom they hate and want to annihilate? You'll likely suffer the same fate with the Jew, and your willingness to do so and count it a privilege is the demonstration of another wisdom. See how these mysteries come together? If you'll be faithful to be what you ought in its fulfillment. The heart of what is apostolic is the glory of God forever. That's why it's got to be through him, that it might be to him. It's not our well-meaning intention, our religious obligation. If we show them only a Chinese face, a religious obligation, we have failed. We've got to show them the face of their God. How do you know God lives? I'm tired of this God talk. Well, she said, without hesitating a moment, lifting up that little snub Gentile face to me, I know that God lives on. He lives in me. Boom. Down I went. knocked out flat. I thought, when I recovered, what hit me? What did she say? It wasn't even intellectual. It wasn't spiritual. But it was true. And that little snub face proved it. There was a light in that face. It was the light that lightens the Gentiles and is the glory of the people of Israel. And I didn't know there was a glory of a people of Israel until I saw the light in the face of a Gentile. And unless we see it there, we'll not see it at all. You've got to reveal it. And it's going to take more than the face of self-conscious religious obligation. It's going to require the face of deeply sanctified saints who count it a privilege to suffer for the redemption of Israel, for it's the coming of their king and his kingdom and his glory forever. How are you going to come to that sanctification? How are you going to come to that deep inward working by which you're not easily offended if somebody looks at you the wrong way and is mean-spirited and is ungrateful, which now can easily offend you? You're offended by Christians. What will you do with these Jews? Take a deep breath. Something authentic has got to be wrought in you. And there's only one place where that operation and sanctification is effected. It's in the church, that is in the church. Unto him be glory in the church, world without end throughout all ages, which is more than the conglomerate of casual saints sharing an auditorium. That's where the working takes place. The rubbing, the grit, the encounter, the confrontation, the disappointment, the disillusionment. I remember one of the earliest times I spoke this message, and I quoted Paul, "By your mercy they shall obtain mercy." Some black lady cried out in the congregation, said, "But Brother Archie said, we don't even have mercy for each other." I said, "Exactly. But you know what? If you had not been faced by the crisis that's before you with Israel, you would not have recognized the truth of your present condition. And you would have lived like that and not dealt with the absence of mercy. But now you're compelled to see to it with each other that you might see to it for them in their coming." You mustn't be guilty of moral cowardice and just being a casual conglomerate of those who share a room for the purpose of a service. We're in something together. We need to take those Chinese masks off of civility, decorum, privacy, keep your distance, my respect, my face, my prestige. That's got to go. We've got to be open and beholding in each other's faces, move from glory to glory in the knowledge of the face of God and reflect that face. That when they see it in your face, how devastated those Jews will be. They never expected to see in your face the glory of the people of Israel. But your light is invincible, and it's not artificial. It's authentic. It's ingrained. It's wrought. It's consistent. You're exhibiting the life of their God, and that's exactly what moves them to jealousy. Who ever expected to find it in Gentiles? And of all Gentiles, Chinese? To find it there is to find the glory of God. That's the mystery, saints. And it's so exquisite, so in the heart of God, that he does not think it extravagant to uproot Jews from Toronto or San Francisco or Hawaii or wherever they are, or New York or Brooklyn, and bring them to Malaysia through cargo ships, through Chinese container cargo ships that I saw at the Panama Canal, just barely with 2 feet of water on each side, stacked high with containers. And I looked at that, I thought, how long will it be before Jews will be moved like merchandise in container compartments that have been ventilated through Chinese ships moving from Asia to the West and West to Asia? They're bringing Jews to that they might be sifted through the nations, not only for their own sake, but that the nations themselves will be sifted and the church within the nations. It's not too extravagant for God to perform this globally, and he'll have 3.5 years in which to do it before the surviving remnant will return to Zion with everlasting joy upon their heads and mourning and sighing fleeing away. Can you imagine that we're at the threshold of this great saga, this symphonic thing, and that most of the church is profoundly ignorant that it's even going to take place, and doesn't even desire that it should take place. So people say, Art, when is this going to happen? Has God given you a time sequence? No. I think everything is ready. Israel is ready to explode. They're hanging on by their fingernails. They're threatened from every side. There's no way that they can resist the atomic threat that will come through Iran, or the onslaught of Palestinians outraged by the wall, overflowing like a great tsunami into Israel and coming into their cities to slay, to rape, to loot, and to destroy, that when the Lord comes in Zechariah, two-thirds have already perished, and the women have been ravaged. That's ready to break. What holds it back? The church is not yet prepared to receive them in flight. Because God said when my foot stepped over the chain of that bankrupt boys' camp that they asked me to visit just as a lark and a novelty, being a speaker in northern Minnesota, the moment my foot came down on the ground, the Lord said, Dominion, End Time Teaching Center, Community, Refuge. And so for 32 years, we have been laboring and sacrificing. Not a place anyone would choose to establish a community as a refuge. But I'll tell you this, saints, if you're not a community, you'll not be a refuge. It's going to take the corporate tested strength and character and life of a people who dwell together and have worked through their own issues in order to be able to absorb the impact and the shock of Jews coming to them in their untoward condition. A community must precede a place of refuge. And a community is not some kind of novel alternative to the church. Community is definitively what God intends church to be. For those who believe were together. See, the crisis of Israel compels us to be the church and gives us the incentive to be the bride, while at the same time we are the factor for Israel's redemption and return and survival. All the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and the knowledge of God. When have you said, oh, last? When have you gasped? When have you doubled over? When have you sensed the symphonic proportions of this great mystery? Because once having been touched by it, you'll be symphonic, whether it's the issue of Jews or not. In fact, you'll be more effectual to the Gentile because of it. Because you've gone to the Jew first, you'll be effectual to the Greek later. There's a mystery even in the divine ordering of God, starting with what is most difficult, which we have circumvented and avoided in our cowardice, sensing that the Jews are tough and that we don't have what it takes and that our spirituality will not be sufficient to meet the challenge of their unbelief. The Jew first and also to the Greek. We have paid a price for our neglect of God's divine mandate and ordering. And the principalities and the powers of the air who look down upon us and hear our choruses and Lord, Lord this and Lord that and Lord, Lord, they say, baloney. Because if he were Lord, he would have gone to the Jew first and also to the Greek. But in ignoring that requirement and that divine ordering and mandate, you give a clear evidence that he's a Lord only verbally but not in fact. The issue of the Jew is the issue of the church. The issue of the church is the issue of their salvation and their redemption. And the whole thing is the issue of God's glory forever. So when the fullness of the Gentiles become in, you will have transcended your cultural and ethnic origins. You'll be full of Hebraic sap. You'll be full of the Psalms and the prophets. Your mentality will be prophetic and apostolic. You will have come to a fullness that is more than the issue of number. Though the issue of number is not insignificant either, because we're called to replace all of the fallen angels who today constitute the principalities and powers of the air. There's a fullness that must come in. So you have an incentive for your world evangelism, for the local community, to see that every soul has opportunity to be saved so that the fullness can come in. The issue of Israel is the ultimate incentive for the fulfillment of our evangelistic and mission purposes in the earth. For there that fullness releases the deliverer to come out of Zion and take transgression from Jacob, according to my covenant unto them, when I shall take away their sins, in verse 27, because all Israel shall be saved, as it is written. Listen, dear saints, what kind of a church are we that is not concerned for the fulfillment of what is written and the covenant which he has made with them? For if he fails to fulfill what is written and cannot fulfill the covenant with them, despite their condition, how is he God? The issue of Israel's redemption is the issue of God forever, so that his praises might ring forth from one coast to the other, from one end of the earth to the other, in the recognition of what God is as he has revealed himself in his mercy toward Israel through the church. So they are the enemies of the gospel for your sake. You need that enemy. You need that opposition. You need that challenge, because you're resting on your haunches. You've got it too easy. You're going to places where you're likely to be more received than if you confronted a Jew. But the gifts and callings of God are without repentance. For in times past that you have not believed God, you have now obtained mercy through their unbelief. Even so, these also now have not believed, that through your mercy they also may obtain mercy. When Moses asked God, show me your glory, he showed him his mercy. For God's mercy is his glory. And he concludes the whole redemptive drama of mankind by the exhibition of his mercy to those who don't deserve mercy, but receive it, because it's not the issue of the deserving, it's the issue of what he is in himself. Because you have obtained mercy, God is going to call you to extend mercy. And where will the Jew ever need mercy more than in the last days, in the time of Jacob's trouble, when they are hounded and pursued unto death in all nations by the Islamic presence that has now proliferated the entire world and is lying low, waiting for the signal to ravage, to tear, and to destroy. For God has concluded them all in unbelief, that he might have mercy upon all. Oh, the depths of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable his judgments, his ways past finding out. Who has known the mind of the Lord? Who has been his counselor? Who's going to instruct God? Who has first given to him, it shall be recompense unto him again. For of him and through him and to him are all things, to whom be glory forever. Lord, I'm asking mercy tonight. And this people need mercy to take in and to hear the weight of this mystery as it is intended to be transforming for the church, transfiguring. Provide a candidate, a bride for the bridegroom. So we're asking the mercy of retention, that nothing shall fall to the ground, that we'll deliberate over this. It'll haunt us in the night hours. We'll open up the Bible. We'll read again Romans 11. We'll ponder, reflect on what was said. We'll take it deeply into our spirit. We'll be willing to become a community, that we might become a refuge, whatever the sacrifice and cost, and it will require. Something will be set in motion because of tonight that is historic, as it will affect all the future, and for which we need mercy for its fulfillment. If I need mercy to communicate and you need mercy to hear, what will you require to fulfill? So, my God, sink these things deep into our hearing. Change us by it. Save us from shallowness. Bring us to a symphonic appreciation of the greatness of this mystery, for it speaks so profoundly of you as no single other thing does.